Oh, the shape up or get. If you let all the fans down.
Can we not lock this?
It's a fact. I am not playing mind games. I am talking about facts.
I always said if I was Aladicio, they'd probably say I was more of a tactical genius.
The answer questions on anything. Religious, politics, health, you know, sexual problems.
Look at his face! Just look at his face!
None of you, except for those two, have done anything to justify the money that you earn. None of you! Disgrace!
And I suggest you shut up and show more football.
All right, welcome along to Team 33. I'm Raf Giallo. As always, you can get in touch with us on Twitter at Team 33. We're also on Facebook and also on iTunes. You can get all our podcasts on offtheball.com and newstalk.com as well. Main interview today will be with Sam O'Shaughnessy, who basically he's a childhood friend of Stephen Doyle, one of my colleagues in here, and he played for a Bermudan football club with a very catchy name, Flanagan's Onions, and that's why we got him in to chat about that whole experience of playing for that club and playing in Bermuda. But Joe Coffey is here after a disappointing weekend for Mayo.
Oh, Jesus, Raf. Hold me.
Derek Ryan is back.
Hello.
Killian Woods is actually not in the Galway studio today. He's actually with us.
How are you, Raf? Full strength championship team here.
We're not even done yet. Yeah. We've strong backups here. Jonathan Higgins.
Hello, hello, hello.
Keane Roach.
Hi, Raf.
And on the line, Enda Call, phoning it in for the first time in his short career so far. How are you?
How are you, lads?
Not bad.
This must be one of the first times we have had literally everybody present.
I know, we've had a couple of these.
Have we?
Yeah, there's been a few mic sharing.
There's a few and far between now, in fairness, but still.
But beyond the main interview I mentioned with Sam O'Shaughnessy, there is a lot to talk about as well. I think the big thing that jumped out for me, apart from Leitrim's fourth win in a row
in
Division 4, has to be mentioned. Like, Joe brings up Mayo all the time, so I think it's only fair.
All the time.
We have nothing to shout about.
And not only that, but the most interesting stat I heard about that was three of the four wins have come with last minute points.
Yeah,
and
we've
our wins in entry time.
And we've been trailing in most of the games.
In all four
games,
at least we've been trailing at half time. So he's doing some good work there.
Yeah, this is probably the greatest moment in our history over the last decade. Like, we've been mired in Division 4
since the 1994 Eurovision, I would think. It's the highlight.
1994 is a great year for us.
The fact as well, on this morning, the AM show did a poll for, you know, manager of the year so far.
Yes.
You know, you were pushing up. I think that speaks volumes.
Yeah, no, because they left out Terry Highland out of the list.
I don't think they did. Really leave him out?
Well, my tweet
Terry
response,
Highland was left out.
He was not mentioned in the four great managers of the year. Yeah.
Well, sure, Christ almighty, like, Leitrim are one of the only unbeaten teams. How
exactly
could they not be it?
Exactly.
Does no football exist outside Division 1?
Probably. I had a word with Owen Shane anyway, and he actually agreed with me. He did push for Terry Highland, but unfortunately I think he may have been overruled. But anyway, away from Leitrim football before we bore our listeners, the big thing that jumped out to me at the weekend, of course, wasn't even Liverpool Man United or the fact I got that prediction right, but Kepa. What a dramatic moment on the sideline. I open it up.
Discuss.
Discuss.
I've seen it all before.
It wouldn't happen in Leitrim, I'll tell you that.
No, it wouldn't. So, we don't generally have enough substitutes to bring on.
So you got a 1 week, fine.
Yeah,
okay, which is complete and utter madness.
But isn't it mad that I watched United Liverpool for my sins on Sunday, and then it was so bad I just decided not to watch the League Cup final.
I called that a few weeks ago.
Yeah,
you did actually say it,
but it was just such a bad game that I was like, I'm not wasting another couple hours of my life on a Sunday watching football, so I didn't bother watching it. But it is amazing though that you would forget that City had won the League Cup at all. I mean, that's completely forgotten.
Mm. Leg one of a possible quadruple, still very much on the cards for them. Yeah. My point is, he got a one week fine from Chelsea, Kepa. Which makes absolutely no sense. Either he did nothing wrong, which is what Sarri and he said after the game. Sarri even said himself it was a confusion. Or he did something very, very much wrong, which is a lot more than 1 week fine. You know what I mean?
But also, I mean, I don't think their whole... I mean, as well coordinated as the communications between the two of them were afterwards to clear up the mess.
Yeah.
I don't understand how it could happen. I mean, would the doctor not just come back over and say... Yeah, no, look, he actually doesn't need to come off.
I think it was a tactical substitution because Willy Caballero used to play for them, obviously.
But this is what they're saying, that like, I thought he had to come off because of his cramp. But would the doctor not come over and clear all that up? Like, he's saying 4 minutes later, the doctor came over and cleared all this up.
I think quite clearly what happened was that
it was a tactical substitution
and Kepa wouldn't come off.
And I mean, they used the cramp thing then as an excuse.
Because like the guy, it was whatchamacallum, played for Man City, knows all the players, has a great record.
Willy Caballero.
Yeah, has a great record for stopping, for saving penalties. I mean, it made complete sense to be making this tactical substitution.
I'm not aware, I'm not sure was Kepa aware why he was being subbed off. I think he probably presumed as well that he was being subbed off because of his cramp or whatever it
possibly
was. And he's confused because all he does, he turns around and just wags the
finger.
Yeah. And nobody seems to have come over and communicated. Obviously, they can't shout across.
I mean, the most telling thing of all the problems in Chelsea was the only one who went over to say something to him was David Luiz.
Yeah, and where's your captain in that instance? Yeah. Like, this had to be. You need your captain running over, speaking to the Zola.
It could clearly could have been. It could have been easily cleared up.
Who was captain of the day?
Azpilicueta.
Azpilicueta, who is Kepa's compatriot, so.
Yeah. And he says he didn't see it. He was on the far side of the pitch and I didn't see what was happening. Well, I mean, if you're on the far side of the pitch,
that's a Wenger line. Yeah. I did not see it.
Like, but the whole situation was just a farce, really. Look, the fact that it happened in the first place, look, it is a horrible thing to happen. I don't care. Like, I'd have no big love for Chelsea or whatnot, but I felt bad there for Sarri at the time.
His career at Chelsea is over.
It has to be over.
His reaction on the sideline was quite telling. He almost walked out.
He walked back and he kind of came back again and throws the bottle down.
He was doing almost like an Incredible Hulk routine because he was about to rip off his jacket. He slams something down on the seat when he really walked off.
That was a massive moment. Was he going to come back in at all as Chelsea manager? Was this the last time we see him as a Chelsea manager? Because he looked like he was walking out of the Chelsea job nearly.
He could well end up staying on for the rest of the season and Chelsea will limp into sixth or wherever they're going to finish.
But he clearly has no long-term future.
No, I think he's done. And I think Kepa, well, only for the have a transfer ban, I'd say he probably would have been done as well.
But the thing about
I'm not sure about that because the player power at Chelsea and actually across football probably means
he's exasperated.
Like, that's mutiny at the highest level, really.
Sarri can't play, like, but this is the thing, like, I go, you know, really, Sarri shouldn't play him now, but he'll probably have to play him because if you're going around saying, well, it's cramp, you have to stick to the story, so of course you're going
to
get
that. He spoke today to say that he may play tomorrow against, who are they playing tomorrow? Oh, they're playing Spurs. He may or he may not play tomorrow. So he said himself, I'm not sure if I will pick him or not tomorrow. So they're already deviating away from the whole, it was an innocent mistake sort of thing to, I may punish him more tomorrow by dropping him.
I'd say
that he could be dropped.
It was just funny, like, it was a bit strange, like, it was handled so badly that the incident happened. And then there's the cover-up, you know, from both sides. And you're thinking, oh, God, here we go. He doesn't stand a chance. And then a day later to come back going, oh, actually, no, he was wrong. We find him. Like, that's gone 360 straight away in a couple of hours. It just shows the complete farce, you know.
Defining doesn't make any sense.
No, because it's contradicted to what we said, though. I didn't realise it was cramp. You know, it was like, let's be honest, it was never cramp. It was a tactical decision.
And also, the reaction of Sarri isn't the reaction of somebody who believes that, well, hang on, let's just check what's going on here.
Yeah, oh no. Yeah.
It's not, you know, like, I mean, like,
he went nuts on the sideline.
Like, it wouldn't be
nuts.
The reaction of what someone who's like, I'm not as emotional as Sarri, so probably not. In a normal situation where you're going, he's not coming off, you'd be like, well, find out why he's not coming off. It wouldn't be that you start banging and throwing things. Like, there could have been a lot more going on leading up to that.
That's what I was wondering beforehand. Was it something that Kepa knew was going to happen and he wasn't happy about being taken off because he wanted to be part of this penalty shootout? This is what I was thinking at the time. And Kepa not coming off was he was making a stand and everyone in Chelsea knew that he was making a stand, but Sarri couldn't do anything about it. If he didn't come off the pitch, it doesn't
matter. I'd love to know then, if that is the story, why isn't Sarri selling them down the river?
Well, I think Sarri knows his days are numbered there as well.
There's nothing to lose.
But if you pick, as Mourinho showed, if you pick on Chelsea's players, you don't really have much longer there.
No, I don't think he's much longer there. Yeah. They're probably going to lose to Spurs. They'll probably lose a few more games and finish like that. I'd say they'll finish in around 6th, 7th place.
Wow. They can probably drop as far as 7th, but yeah.
No, it's probably 6th, maybe. Yeah. You know, I mean, like, it's not as if they were playing that well. Like, they played all right in that game.
But which, by the way, is mad, considering in October they're still unbeaten.
Sure, we're talking about them being
potential title challengers. Yeah. Like, October, they're still unbeaten.
I mean, they were well, like, I mean, an Arsenal form is indifferent, but they were well beaten by Arsenal, like. And I'd always gauge that as kind of like, if you're being well beaten by Arsenal,
that's a bad barometer, isn't it?
Well, you were looking at them when they came away with a 2-0 win against City, and you were like, Jesus, like, Chelsea actually do look the real, maybe not the real deal, but like, Sarri has a bit of something about him. And then it's unbelievable how it's all fallen apart, like, absolutely unbelievable. I was surprised that Sarri actually never went onto the pitch during that whole back and forth between the two, because obviously Kepa wasn't going to come over to him.
Yeah,
that's what he should have done.
Yeah,
that's, he should have went on the pitch and dragged him off with the scruff of the neck.
But I was.
That's what would happen to the club in a GA.
I think employment law probably precludes any of that kind of physical.
But if he was willing to go and walk out, like he got as far as the door was open for him, and he turned around.
Yeah.
Like
yeah,
he was
before the penalty shootout. Actually, Rudiger's holding Sarri back a little bit as Kepa's standing a couple of feet away, pointedly not looking in Sarri's direction. It was
it's humiliating for Sarri. There, yeah. It's humiliating for Sarri.
Oh, 100%.
Of course. Honestly, you know what I mean? Whatever happened, Kepa humiliated him. Even if he felt he was in the right, or even if he felt it was he thinks I'm injured and I'm not injured, he still humiliated Sarri. And you have to feel sorry for Sarri. You know,
you do, because at the end of the day, like regardless of what actually went on, it was complete humiliation for Sarri. And if you think of any other manager that would happen to, Alex Ferguson, Kepa would never play for the club again. Jose Mourinho, you saw what he did with the physio, let alone a player not doing what he wanted to do.
I just don't know what the logic is now for managing Chelsea. I mean, if you're a pretty high-profile manager...
Where's the logic of supporting Chelsea?
What are you
supporting?
How
could a Chelsea fan look at that? It's like, so they're embarrassed on the pitch for Man City. Oh, couldn't get much worse. Now you're just a laughing stock in general, because not even the team are... You can fix the team. This is just rotten to the core. What do you do? Like, as a Chelsea fan, what do you even boo? Like,
yeah. Well, Chelsea are a joke of a club anyway.
I put them there.
The last 15 years under Abramovich's rule have just been instability, but it's success under instability. So the Chelsea fans are looking at this, they're like, well, I mean, the last 15 years we've been the most successful club in England based on the instability that we've had. So I don't think it bothers them that much, to be honest.
But the money has dried up for them now, and that's the real problem.
Yeah, and if they can't appeal this transfer ban,
if you can keep buying the best players, it doesn't. The way Chelsea are, as long as you had a half decent manager, for however long they lasted, you were going to win stuff. But now that the players are drying up, it doesn't really matter who's managing them. That because you're presiding over the Titanic.
Yeah, and as well as that, I think I'll even go as far as the short term outlook for Chelsea. I think is very, very unstable. You're looking at a new manager in the summer with no players to buy, a lot of disgruntled players that we saw that have a lot of player power. Like, what do you go with? They're going to have to change the whole culture. They won't be able to spend. Now they're going to be pulling back loan players.
Yeah.
Players will want to leave. You know, they could drop down again to the level that we had pre-Abramovich. Really.
Let's be honest here. The transfer ban is meaningless. They're going to be signing players.
Well, absolutely, no. Basically, the appeal will mean they'll get a stay of execution, and then
even without an appeal, they're going to be signing players. Transfer bans are complete and utter meaningless. Look at PSG. PSG, Barcelona, all have had transfer bans the last 2 years, and they've been signing players right, left, and center. It's meaningless.
Yeah, but what I'd like to know is, though, where is the money going to come for Chelsea to sign these players?
Well, probably the Hazard sale.
They'll have to sell.
Well, to be honest, it all kind of hangs on Abramovich as well, because his future in England's still up in the air after the whole situation with Brexit and Theresa May banning some oligarchs from England and freezing assets. So his future as a British citizen is still pretty up in the air, whether he gets a work permit or not.
I think he's gone for his Israeli passport, so I think he's pretty much given up on the whole. He hasn't been in England now since last April. That's almost a year ago.
Yeah, see, that just shows you, like, the whole club's in a bit of a mess right now.
Yeah, and, like, even from speaking, because Chelsea played a friendly here in Dublin during the summer, and I got talking to some of the Chelsea, you know, journalists that cover them week in and week out, and they were telling me about all the cuts off the field, even small little things about food cuts in the canteens, no more hot food.
I heard they had one of the best canteens in...
They did, but the hot food went for this season. The signs...
As canteens go.
The stadium was the big thing. There was like they were full steam ahead for the stadium, and then all of a sudden, all this happens with Abramovich, and the papers start talking about it, and then the stadium was pumped.
And then, you know, you've all these small... Like, they're like, let's be honest, hot food in the canteen is not going to make any difference to what happens on the pitch, but all these signs put together, these small little things show
I wouldn't be too sure about that. That's what happened with Moisey. That was one of the first things. He banned the chips, and that was
this in the press room it's just shown the kind of the outlook, and his outlook is I'm not going to spend any more money here. The small little cuts, and they just show a little change in direction. Which, like, they're all small things put together, but you put them all together, it shows his outlook is changing a little bit. It's not like the glory days where he's throwing money around left, right, and centre.
Yeah, like, I mean, they're not in the market for the big players anymore.
No. Or for the best mince pies in the press box.
But there's a tiny change in the Premier League as well, in that, like, Arsenal have no money, supposedly. Like, yeah, absolutely no money.
I find that incredible.
Which is amazing. I don't really understand how they have none, but they have none. And, you know, so then you're looking at it and you're going, well, Liverpool have money, United have money. I don't know if Spurs are going to have money. Man City have money. And that's kind of it. Like, I mean, a lot of the clubs then are all in the same boat. I mean, like, a lot of clubs are have money, but, like, you know, they have to set... But you're not talking about, like, they're not going to be going out buying, spending 70 million on Lukaku, you know? Or if you are in the market for and you have 50 or 60 million, it's because you sold somebody for 70 million. And so, like, there's going to be a lot of clubs there in the next couple of years that are all competing for the same kind of player, and then there'll be the three clubs out in front who are competing for the best of the best. That's the way it looks like to me, anyway. If Liverpool win the league this year, I think they'll go into another market for the type of player they're after. Whether they can afford them, I don't know, but they seem to have money.
Yeah, I think Liverpool will be in the market pretty heavy in the summer. And it was they need a new striker. Yeah. They probably need another centre half and number 10 as well. But the early talk is that they're going to go big in for a striker in the summer. That's going to be
if they win the league. I mean, well, who did this? You know, there's not, they can sign whoever they really want to sign.
Yeah, well, I think that the draws back, like in terms of the attraction of the club to be able to attract key players and big players, that's become easier. So they're shopping in a different market. TV money is huge, like the Champions League money as well from last season. It's a hell of a lot different to what even we look at.
Liverpool are... Listen, but then winning the league would be great for the league, I think, and that's hard to say. Not as an anti-Liverpool fan, not as a Man United fan, as an anti-Liverpool fan.
lots of
but I think they're on the verge of now this kind of Klopp burnout phase of their life.
Shagged, I have to say.
I mean, in the Klopp burns clubs out in general. Dortmund when he left, they weren't looking great.
Like that. Like, I mean, the game on Sunday, like, it was a bad game anyway. And fair enough, United are going a full tilt, but Liverpool looked tired. I thought
they haven't been the same team for me since the City defeat. Confidence wise, their confidence dropped since then. They've had a couple of obviously good results in that time, but they haven't just looked the same. They're firing on all cylinders from about October until that game, and even though they should have probably could have definitely won that game, certainly got a draw against City at the Etihad, but after that defeat they just haven't really been the same team for me, and they're kind of not as on fire as they were before that.
They could do with a Champions League exit.
I don't know. I think momentum is key now at the moment. You've seen that with, like, it was a horrible game at the weekend.
And to be honest, I thought the Bayern Munich match wasn't up to much either.
That was another cagey affair. Yeah. But like, Liverpool are in a situation now where, up to this season, the biggest taboo in Liverpool's form was trying to break down smaller teams who park the bus. Now it's kind of gone full circle. You have a lot of bigger teams like Munich, Manchester United, sitting back nice and compact, and that's a different challenge because what you've done, but one solution to break down smaller teams just doesn't happen with qualities of your Manchester United's and your Bayern Munich. So it's a different challenge. It's a different thought process.
But like, you drop points against West Ham away again. That was another poor game.
That was horrible.
That's what I'm saying. There's been a couple of results, and you know, you beat Brighton 1-0. That was the game after City, was it? Around the time of City.
Yeah, well, it's 1-5 at the moment.
You know what I mean? It's just like
4-0 win against Bournemouth has been there.
Exactly. Yeah. There were one or two highlights, but since then it's just been like winning games by a goal, or you know what I mean, or dropping points against. I mean, United had a lot of injuries, obviously, in the first half of that game. I actually didn't see the game in full, but this is a great chance to beat United at Old Trafford, and I don't think they came anywhere near even creating much just to win the game.
It was a horrible game.
Like that for me is like before the start of January when you lost to City, Liverpool were on fire. Like they looked like they were going to walk the league nearly by the end.
That said, I think this was always going to happen at some stage.
They were given a free range.
Sorry to talk across you.
That's right. I was talking across you first, Joe, and I'm doing it again now.
The key though is. And like, I think these things happen to most clubs in a title run in at some stage. But it's particularly the good title. Well, the title run-ins that are memorable, this always happens. And the key is which club will get out of the slump quicker. I mean, City aren't in one now at the moment, but they already had one.
They
got out of it pretty quickly. So it's how quickly will Liverpool get out of the slump now and string together four or five wins in a row? Because that's what they're going to need to do to win the league.
But the big thing really is... You have to strip back and look at it. Like, Brendan Rodgers is in the news at the moment. We'll speak about him a little bit later. But Brendan Rodgers' team at Old Trafford would have gone gung-ho and would have lost that game.
Yeah, probably. Yeah.
There's a bit more of a balance in this,
like,
at the moment.
I mean, Klopp
used to play that way, and I'm just interested this whole season. It's all, and to use a Wenger phrase, they're playing with the handbrake on a little bit.
A little bit.
There's no comparison between this Liverpool team and Brendan Rodgers' Liverpool team. By the way, this Liverpool team is far superior
in terms of attitude as well.
And even this Liverpool team compared to last season, where, like you say, they would have gone gung-ho, and this Liverpool team is far better, far more balanced. Yeah. Not as exciting to watch. Everyone loved last season seeing the front three go crazy. This team isn't as exciting to watch, but it's a better all-round team. That Rodgers team, and I know we're going to talk about it in a while, but that Rodgers 2014 team was based solely for me on Suarez and momentum, and the rest of the squad was kind of a bit shite, to be honest. This team is a far better team, so there's no comparison between those two.
It's just the attitude in terms of they realise, it's the same with the Munich game as well, not to go gungo. I know they nearly got caught at the end with the small goal. That happens every now and again in football. It team gets a kind of a bit of a momentum change, but by and large the outlook is this team. And it goes back to a quote that Klopp said in the summer in the Viva after the friendly against Napoli. He said it's not about winning a game 5-0, it's about winning 5 games 1-0, and that's struck daggers in me straight away. And you can see that footprints throughout the squad. Now don't get me wrong, Liverpool aren't in the best of form. I didn't think the performance, watched it back again last night, I didn't think it was as bad as people made out. I think the game, people are laughing at Klopp saying, you know, the injuries ruined the game, but they definitely took the momentum away of the game. And you only have to look at the stats. Like, there was about another 15 minutes of football that didn't get played in that game at the weekend. Like, the average, without getting too nerdy, Liverpool United play about, if you look at the stats, about 58 minutes of football. It was down to 46. You know, so that's another 14, 15 minutes of solid football. It makes a big difference. It was a game that never really got going, but Liverpool United games over the years have been horrible. They've never, like, everyone talks about it, but the most watched game in football. I wouldn't like it to be that situation, because
it's the hype, I think. It gets hyped to such a point, and then, you know, well, it's in football and everything, actually, generally in life. Like, once anything is hyped to the rafters.
That's very deep, Raph.
Well, look, just had Oscars and stuff where I'm sure some films were hyped, like A Star is Born, etc. I actually didn't watch it, so I can't really comment.
That's pretty good, Raph.
I saw the 1977 version, which is actually decent, with Chris Christopherson.
I like the
right tangent hipster over here.
God, there's a right tangent.
I'm in the deep end, Raph. Watch as I dive in.
Here's my shadow, or whatever was
I'll
that.
Never reach the ground.
Whatever was that.
I don't know how that happened, but anyway, let's move on.
Just the overall point is that, like, if you were a football fan that mightn't, or a sports fan that mightn't necessarily watch football every now and again, you go, I'll watch this big match. This is not the game you should be watching, because even when, like, there's been so many horrible games, you get excited for them every time. I generally hate games at Old Trafford because Liverpool's record is absolutely horrendous there. Like, you can count on one hand what I can remember in Liverpool's lifetime, victories there, you know, and by and large after that, they're horrible. They're 1-0 crappy little wins on both sides, really. There's never really been a situation where both teams are kind of coming into it in form and you have an enthralling end-to-end game. Like, the game, like, United sat, even before the injuries, they sat so deep, they were so compact, they were never going to get run over. The aim was, here, we're going to stop Liverpool play, and then in the second half, with the injuries, and probably rightly so, they just closed up shop altogether, and they just pretty much sat everyone behind the ball. That was even evidenced before the injuries. Like, I remember it was so weird I took a screenshot of it when I was watching back last night. At one stage, this was before the injuries, it was like 8 players in
was
a line,
like in place of sleeping pills or something.
Well, yeah, the football nerd and all that, that's what it does to you. But, you know, like, they sat deep. There was clearly a tactic of, look, we're not going to get beat here. But the game was never really allowed to develop. You know, it was a shame, really, because it could have been so much more.
But it's just, I'm actually just looking at comparing and contrasting Liverpool and City's remaining fixtures. And, like, okay, Liverpool have Everton, they've Watford this week. And then
the
Everton at the weekend. But, like, Liverpool have a lot of very winnable games. I mean, they've got Chelsea, which, to be honest, going on current form, they should win that handy. Spurs, but they've got Spurs at home. The only one that I go could be a potential tricky one is Newcastle away.
A
chance for Newcastle to avenge the 1990, was it 96, 97? The 4-3 run-in against Liverpool.
But I think Newcastle have slightly more bigger issues to worry about, like relegation probably for that game, than avenging a 22-year-old game.
But actually it hinges, like, it's, look, interesting though. City have Tottenham and then they have United 4 days apart. So that'll be
the biggest thing, really, is the Brendan Rodgers going to pack and do us a favour the second last game of the season.
That's
there.
True.
You've had
Roy Hodgson,
you've had Rafa. Already do Liverpool a favour.
The issue, the point for me is City's squad is so much stronger than Liverpool's. Yeah. If City don't get many injuries and get players back, like Kevin De Bruyne has been pretty much
I think United have a better squad than Liverpool.
Oh, they do.
Yeah.
Most definitely.
Liverpool have a very good 12-13 players.
The
look on Keane's face is something completely different.
Look at the changes.
I just think they had a lot of players that weren't being utilised correctly.
Then you get the likes of Sanchez, who's poor.
I always said that United had a fantastic... We were sitting in this studio like in October before Christmas saying like the team of players that United had are very, very good. Like you had some very top-class players in there. But I don't know. Like, I don't know if they're necessarily better than any of the Liverpool players.
Oh, they are, like the defensive side maybe, but look at the options up front.
I'd love to know what United would have done this season if they had the belief they currently have. Mm. Because to be honest, all I think that's really changed is the belief in the team.
Oh, 100%.
Like, I don't really think...
and the mentality of...
But that's what I'm talking, like the whole thing.
The whole mentality, yeah. Well, there's nothing else has changed. Like, tactically, United aren't much superior now than they were.
But on current form, like, if you had Mane, Firmino, if he was fit, and Salah, okay, maybe not taken into... the last two games, like, so over the course of the season, like, you wouldn't, like, who of United gets in there? Like, maybe Rashford.
Martial gets in the Liverpool. Rashford gets close to being in.
Yeah. But Martial doesn't get into that Liverpool front three.
I don't think so. I don't think
Pogba does. Rashford does.
Pogba does.
Yeah. Rashford probably does. But Martial doesn't. I love Martial.
De Gea
does. I love Rashford, but like, I love Martial, but his form is so inconsistent over the whole season that he wouldn't be getting to that front three.
I'd love him at Liverpool, but the point is that you look at Liverpool's squad, yes, the team 1-11 is on par with City, United, etc. But after that, you look at the options and you even look at it at the weekend, the game just come by there, like Sturridge is a shadow of himself. Like he offered nothing. Like people go on about...
Like Sturridge got that amazing goal against Chelsea.
Liverpool career has kind of dragged on a lot more than I would have thought, and we clearly need a replacement there, same as with Origi. Like if they are such a drop down, like City would have won that game at the weekend with their substitutes.
Isn't it mad though that Liverpool that City have such a strong squad that like Kevin De Bruyne, for example, who like I say, he's been out pretty much all season, he's been in and out of the team, he's been coming back then getting injured again, he was their star player last season. Season he hasn't been in anywhere near.
Is he fit yet?
He keeps getting injured and then he's out for a while and then coming back. Yeah. But like they're a point off the top of the table without their star player from last season. So my point is if they get De Bruyne back, if they get company to play more than two games a month, but if they get these players back between now and the end of the season, for me, that will win them the league. Their strength off the bench, which is where Liverpool struggle. I think Shaqiri's been a brilliant signing for Liverpool. But apart from that,
he's faded the last month or so. Because he had a couple of niggly injuries and he just hasn't been himself.
Yeah. Mahrez has been poor.
But he's still a player that you could bring on and you know, expect a piece of magic off him, or he could have the potential to do that. And I think if you look back at it and strip back from the emotional, look back to where we were at the summer, if you'd have thought this Liverpool squad compared to that Man City squad are a point ahead of them at this stage in the season, I think that all Liverpool fans would have grabbed your hands off of that. I know it could have been so much better and the potential was to be, but I think it's still there's a long way to go yet and who knows what way it'll go. But it's still a fantastic season to be even in this.
It's a phenomenal achievement.
It's in a form. It is really amazing. When you look at the squads and look at particularly the drop off and those substitutes compared to Man City.
A quick word on Solskjaer.
There was a worrying moment actually in the United game where Robertson went down. I thought he'd done his shoulder. Your immediate thought is Alberto Moreno. Your season over. Like one player going.
I don't think even he would have trusted you with Trent.
It'd be Milner.
Yeah, Milner over put Trent.
Say a quick word on Solskjaer. The reaction from the PSG, I kind of wanted to see United lose the game and see how they reacted. And the reaction since the PSG game, for me, says that he has to get the job.
I mean,
beating Chelsea, I know Chelsea are having a disaster, but beating Chelsea and then coming back and doing what they did against Liverpool at Old Trafford, for me, he has to get the job.
Ender?
No.
No!
No.
Who should get the job, Ender?
You're not basing this off a result. You can't base...
I'm basing it off
their result. You just can't.
I'm basing it off the fact that they lost a game and therefore their momentum was stalled by the fact that they lost so badly against PSG and they came back and have done quite well, in my opinion, since that defeat. It was more the manner of the defeat of PSG rather than the loss.
They're showing the fight back that you wanted to see after. I think everyone wanted to see Solskjaer losing the game. to see how they would bounce back. But I mean, if you're basing giving the person a job off any results, then you're going off the wrong things here.
No, it's not the result. It's the recovery from losing a game. I wanted to see how United, you know, like, it's all well and good winning 11 games in a row or 10 games out of 11, momentum's so good, everything's going great. Once that falls, once that stops, which they did against PSG, and they lost quite badly against PSG, you know, it was 2-0, but it could have been a lot worse than that. Coming back from that to win at Stamford Bridge, I know Chelsea are Chelsea at the moment, and drawing with Liverpool, for me that shows that there's more about him than just momentum.
Oh, I completely agree. I think he's doing a great job, and it's not just all confidence that he's doing this from, but I just think that it needs to be an end of the season, sit down, see what he's done, see what he's going to bring to the table, and see does that beat him to the job to say if Pochettino doesn't get the job. I mean, he should be interviewed at the end of the season.
I would agree that
just like the rest of the candidates, and they should pick the best candidate. It shouldn't be based on what he does this year.
Oh, I would agree that, I mean, you're not going to give him the job between now and the end of the season, because there could be barring...
Well, no, let's be real now. Pochettino's not going to allow himself to go in for an interview where he might get the job. Christ almighty, he's managing Spurs, like.
The thing for me is that barring a major fall off in form between now and the end of the season for United, Solskjaer has to get it. The fans alone will turn on the board and whoever the new manager is, because they one Solskjaer as well. Everybody wants Solskjaer.
That's the most difficult thing, is that the fact that the fan power has become so, they're so vocal. You know, you see all the banners at the moment, and he has from that aspect, you know, he's brought life back into the place. Like, we saw many games at the under Mourinho where there's kind of half empty. You look at towards the game, you see empty seats everywhere. Yeah, the whole vibe, even just on the street. So he's brought that back. But I don't know.
There is the element, though, like there is the element that it often happens, a manager comes in, does amazing, and then the new season starts, and it's like, Christ almighty, he hasn't a notion what he's doing, and we've lost 5 games before we know it.
That was my point about him losing a game. It's all well and good winning 11 games in a row and having a great season,
but the factor is still, and I think they could probably, they may well get top four.
I think they will get top four.
They've got a tricky enough run in. United.
Yeah, Arsenal's a slightly better run in.
It'll be a phenomenal achievement though from Arsenal if they manage the top four.
What I would say is, from a Liverpool point of view, I hope that he gets the job, because I just think it would be a bad appointment. And I kind of feel bad saying it in a way. He comes across as a very nice guy. I admire the way he's got the grip of the club, but I just think it's too short term. I just don't think he's proved himself enough in management. I think there's aspects of his game, particularly from a tactical point of view, that I think he will struggle in. And when you have the caliber of a manager like Pochettino, I think I think Manchester United should be going a bar more.
For me, I think Sir Alex Ferguson showed that you don't have to be obviously, Fergie's one of the greatest managers of all time. He showed that you don't have to be a tactical mastermind to be the greatest manager in the world. Fergie wasn't a tactical mastermind.
The game has evolved a lot more now.
But his man management won him everything.
Say,
in
fairness
career.
To Ferguson, I'd say if he was managing now, he'd still be winning league titles.
He would be winning league titles left, right and centre. There's a lot more to management.
Come on.
That's why.
Huh? Oh, no, absolutely.
Are you having a laugh?
Player number two can do their job
that Ferguson wouldn't be winning league titles.
Are you having a laugh that Ferguson wouldn't be one of the top managers right now?
No,
of course
that's what I think.
He reinvented himself 3 times over 20 years, and we're saying that he wouldn't be a top manager now.
I think the point Derek was making was he wasn't a tactical whiz in terms of it wasn't really built on that.
Fergie was never a Pep or a Mourinho insofar as, like, you know, outthink, like, he sent his teams out to win, and his man management won him league title after league title after league title. You saw a 2011 team especially, and 2013 team, those squads were poor. Tactically, they were poor.
I think we're all violently agreeing with you.
but my point is, you don't have to be a tactical mastermind to be very successful. And Solskjaer has maybe has something about him that doesn't mean he's a tactical mastermind, but maybe it's enough to do well. We won't know for 5 years, 5 or 6 years.
I agree, but I think it's a different prospect taking over United next year to what he's doing at the minute.
Yeah.
He takes over next year, it's completely, he gets the full summer to himself to rebuild that club. Rebuild the side to what he wants it to be, and then next season it's completely on his shoulders. There's still no pressure on him, let's be real. There's still absolutely no pressure on Solskjaer.
The real pressure starts when he's fully appointed as a manager.
Yeah.
He
starts going in the transfer market.
Yeah.
And
it's a completely different thing. I think he should be in the running for the job, but I just think he should have to wait until the end of the season, look at what he's done and look what he's bringing forward to the table. He should have to give a complete presentation of a 5-year plan for United and what he wants to achieve.
Don't say 5-year plans when we speak about Brendan Rodgers. Jesus.
So we're just going to have a little...
Will he get the envelopes out as well, will he?
We're just going to have a little Kepa Sarri type statement that we're all going to agree on. Alex Ferguson was a good manager. Can we all tick that one off?
Yeah. What were you saying there, Killian?
I was saying that dryly, by the way. That's not a reinvention
of himself. And this is what really good CEOs and chief executives do is, and what you hear a lot of people who set up companies do, the reason, and they all attribute it, you ask them the same question, what's the success behind your company? They always hire people who are better than them at what they do. And all of Alex Ferguson's successes and reinventions of himself have been hiring better assistant managers to do what his job actually was, which was what Pep Guardiola, now Pep Guardiola does it himself and he gets yes men around him. Yeah, I know it's a different way of management. I'm just saying you eventually stumble across the odd dud in an assistant manager there, and that's why Alex Ferguson hit some bad pass. That's why he wasn't winning the league every year. And I'm not saying he's a bad manager. I'm just saying he wasn't necessarily reinventing the team himself. He was hiring people to do it for him.
Mike Field is back, exactly.
And the really good people to do his bidding essentially, but. I'm not, listen, all of history is against me here.
This is exactly how this show has been run as well.
But I think to say that Alex Ferguson was the mastermind behind reinventing Man United a few times, I think there were people pulling the strings there that he had talent.
That's a big statement.
You know.
What?
Yeah.
Well, what you're saying is Ferguson. Okay, Ferguson was.
He's good at hiring people. That's the most successful companies in the world are about having someone who's good at hiring people. And
but you're saying that's not Ferguson. I'm not saying Ferguson's responsible for that.
I'm saying that doesn't mean he was the one there reinventing the team.
Football history is being rewritten.
I think with the way that there's like now like five different massive personalities in the league, I think he'd struggle to play them. Some of his biggest title wins have been orchestrating the downfall mentally of his opponents.
That's true.
And I think that is much harder when you've got much more strong, like. Klopp isn't going to have like a meltdown like Rafa. He's not going to have a meltdown like Kevin Keegan. I think they are much smarter men now in charge of teams, much more emotionally balanced people. Yeah. More clever foreigners involved, I think, is the thing as well. And I think he would struggle to like Pochettino's like always his full grasp of the English language isn't exactly there.
Sorry to interrupt. It is completely and utterly horse shit, okay, to suggest that the only reason Fergie won leagues was because he mentally outfought the likes of Rafa Benitez and Kevin Keegan. That's complete and utter nonsense to suggest that the only way he won leagues is because he played mind games with Kevin Keegan and Rafa Benitez.
Well, the Kevin Keegan one.
Rafa, are you kidding me? Both of those, the only reason he won 13 leagues
in 20 seasons.
Well, in fairness, Rafa Benitez rocked up to a press conference talking about facts. And you knew the game was up.
I'm saying that is much harder to do now. And a lot of the things that Ferguson was really good at was playing people off each other like that. Was playing off the minds of other people.
And beating them down.
He had a load of groupies in the league essentially doing his bidding and bid. He did. That is absolutely true. He did.
Steve Bruce, Sam Allis,
all who worship the ground he walked on. And I think those people are gone now. And there's a lot more strong-willed people in the league who just wouldn't go for that.
There was a big thing.
To be fair, Jose Mourinho was notoriously weak-minded, you know.
There was a big thing made about Wenger when he first came, that he was the only manager in the league that wouldn't have a glass of wine with Ferguson after a game.
Yeah, well, look, it goes like you can go on various elements. You know, the Fergie time, he definitely the mind games were, he used them as a tactic, and they were, he did it quite regularly, and we can see multiple examples of that. Don't get me wrong. Fantastic man manager. The game has evolved a lot. I don't mean this in a disrespectful way. I just mean in general football point of view. The quality of football in the Premiership has improved a hell of a lot in the last couple of years. And you only have to look at the quality of managers that we've kind of discussed on there. That necessarily wasn't the same. And I think it's one of the reasons why sometimes United struggled in Europe. Like you look at those European Cup finals against Guardiola's Barcelona.
That was the greatest team of all time.
Yes, I agree, with an awful United team who, by the way, had Ryan Giggs in midfield and Chicharito starting.
I just don't understand how we're having the conversation that Alex Ferguson just wouldn't be a good manager, even though it was a completely different thing from when he took over in 1992 to when he finished in 2013. It's absolutely incredible that we're actually considering.
I agree, and by the way, I
think we're all misinterpreting what the points are.
You just suggested that the only reason Fergie won leagues is because he mentally outfought Rafa Benitez and Kevin Keegan.
I will say what I said. I said that I think it's a much different dynamic that he would have to play in the league now. The league is not full of his friends. Not full, might be. He had a significant amount of groupies in the league who worshipped the ground he walked on. I think there's much more personalities he'd have to deal with. And also, what was his man management? My interpretation of that was shouting at players. Young players do not have the generation coming up now do not. Look at Kepa, wouldn't walk off the pitch. We were talking about it earlier. Young players are much more strong-minded, strong-willed, and millennials and our group of generation have been told they can be whatever they want.
It's not a good thing.
Me and Derek are sharing a mic, and I said to him before the show, we shouldn't share a mic. Don't butt in on my mic.
You retired 5 years ago. It's not like you retired 50 years ago.
Saying,
do you think Matt Busby now? How would you?
I think whatever we think or what was interpreted as his man management style. I'm just saying, and again, we have no way of proving that I'm right or anyone else is right. I think it would not work as well now. You can't shout at people anymore. You can't shout at players anymore.
But he didn't just shout at people.
Can I just point out that back in 2004, Jose Mourinho came in and changed football, and everyone said, oh, can United step up to the plate? They stepped up to the plate. They won 5 of the next 7 league titles after Mourinho came in and changed football. And like, no one's going to compete with Mourinho. And his man management style and the way and all the billions that he has at Chelsea, and he came in, Fergie won 5 of the next 7 league titles.
Derek, that wasn't down to Ferguson, that was down to his friends in the Premier League.
Sam Allardyce won those 5 out of 7 league titles.
Let's all just go around the table and say who we're supporting here, who what teams we support, and I think that informs the debate. And
Keane is quite obvious here.
Keane's wearing a jersey. Derek Ren's clearly a Man United fan. Enda, who do you support?
I'm a Finn Harps fan.
Oh, great.
Among other clubs.
Yeah. I'm not saying I'm category writing that Ferguson wouldn't win leagues now. I'm saying it's a much different environment and a much tougher environment now. I'm just saying, it would be geared much more against, it's much stiffer opposition. It really is. He was the head figurehead, which should get credit for all the leagues they've won. He hired really well. He knew he spotted talent. That's spotting someone to do that talent and delegating those tasks. Pep Guardiola couldn't do that. He can't do that. He has to own all that. Same at Wenger, which was eventually his downfall. Spotting talent only goes on for so long. Alex Ferguson had an amazing eye for on the field talent and people to manage people on the field as well. And then on the side of that, he had man management.
He got players like Ashley Young and Tom Cleverley playing well above themselves, so they won a league in 2013. Tom Cleverley was in United midfield in 2013. Tom Cleverley, who I don't even know who he plays for anymore. Watford? Is this? I don't know.
Man management is not just down to those players playing well.
What?
There's a system. I'm not going to buy that one aspect. I'm not going to. If that goes for that, then I can just pick one aspect of Alex Ferguson I don't like and say then he wouldn't be a good manager now.
Yeah, he's playing for a while.
Like there's just many different aspects of players playing well. And they all contribute to it. Man management is categorically not the one reason why once some players play better than they were.
He got players playing consistently above themselves for 20 seasons and they won 13 leagues.
He also had some of the best players the Premier League has ever seen. He wasn't doing this with a band of misfits. He had the greatest
I would argue in the two last league winning.
The last title.
Yeah, the last title was with.
The second last was even worse. The second last 2011 league title. Rooney was having the worst season of his career. Berbatov scored 20 goals. And apart from that, United were awful.
But I will say the one thing that has changed, particularly like since it was definitely changing towards his latter years. But the points total for winning the league now just seems to keep going up and up. I like United when they were You know, the treble winning team won the league title with 79 points.
Where would you finish last year with that?
79 points. I don't know if you...
It's an unfair, it's an unfair question to ask you on the spot.
But my point, made top four, maybe.
But my point is that...
Oh, God. Can we move on to Rodgers?
No matter what came to at Ferguson, you got Wenger back in 98. Ferguson overtook him again and was able to beat him. I think Mourinho came in. Ferguson was able to overtake him as well. City's billions came in 2012, won the league. Ferguson won it again in 2013. Between 1992, and you mentioned that players have completely changed in the last five and a half years, apparently. Between 1992, when I don't know what the average wage was for players in 1992, but it was very, very small compared to what it was in 2013. The whole of English football and football in general massively changed between 1992 and 2013. And Ferguson was able to win 13 league titles in those 20 seasons. So I don't think it's massively changed in the last five and a half years compared to that 20 years.
That said, there have definitely articles have been written about Ferguson, about getting the right staff around himself.
Oh, I completely agree. The best United team was in 2008, and that had Carlos Queiroz as the assistant manager, and he was a brilliant tactician. I completely agree with your point about bringing in people to help the team. That doesn't make, like, you're nearly suggesting that he accidentally is a good manager because he had good people working under him. That's the whole point of being a good manager, to have people at the club who can make the club successful. And that, if that means you're not a master tactician, you bring in a master tactician to be a master tactician, then you have a very good club and a good working club. So Carlos Queiroz was one of his best appointments. I completely agree with
that. The issue I was taking with that was that just to broadly say Alex Ferguson reinvented that club is false. He was the figurehead who picked people around him who did his bidding like that. To say
that he was the master of all trades is wrong, to say that it was just the people he brought in that reinvented the club, though.
Sorry, that way you're taking.
It's disingenuous to say that just because he brought all these good people in that he wasn't involved in the process.
He was involved in the process, but I think to say that he was the one mastermind behind it all.
No, he wasn't the one mastermind behind it all, but he was the main lad.
I think that there's many moving parts we're going around circles here.
Let's all agree that Killian is wrong.
No, look. Alex Ferguson, misunderstood genius.
Anyway, look. Next,
the luckiest man in football, according to Killian.
Next week we'll have an easier debate or a more straightforward one. We will debate the existence of God. I think we'll find out. Does he exist?
God's not responsible for everything.
Is he a figment of our imagination?
God gets good people in on board.
It would be boring radio if we all agreed with each other.
We probably wouldn't, though. Not on the God one, and definitely not on the Ferguson one. But anyway, I'm just going to read a little headline here. Celtic are set to announce on Thursday that Leicester manager Martin O'Neill is their new boss. How times have changed. That's the BBC.
What year was that?
Year 2000.
So back in 2000, it was a good career move to go from Leicester City to Celtic. And like I say, how times have changed that in the last... Well, like 2000, so last 19 years, things have completely turned around. Not only for Leicester, who obviously won the league a few years ago, but for Celtic, let's be realistic, the job is nowhere near as appealing now as it was in 2000.
Yeah, because, like, I mean, he goes to Leicester, he's got money to buy players, I mean, at a certain level. At Celtic, it seemed like he had absolutely no money whatsoever.
And you're the resident Celtic fan, you can clarify that.
Basically, the Celtic board, Peter Laurel, and the rest of the crowd—they've never really invested in the club as such, and they're pretty much just short-terminism people. Like they want the club to go forward, but they only want it to go forward a certain amount so that they keep making money. Celtic have become a feeder club to England, and that's the long and the short of it, really. They spent after winning. Doing an invincible season, and then after winning a double treble in the second season, they spent $7 million on one player, and then they spent $2 million on a light show for Champions League night.
Yep, I was about to say, how long did the disco lights make an appearance?
It's about 30 seconds before the Champions League, and it doesn't add to the atmosphere at all, but it was kind of like, it was the ultimate giving the fingers to Brendan Rodgers, spending $2 million on a light show when he could have brought in a defender for that amount of money that would have helped the team move forward and actually do something in Europe this year.
Was it a good light show?
What's this light show?
It's look it up on YouTube. It's dreadful.
That's
I don't know.
Horrible.
It's
Where did I'd be done?
Was it all in celebration of the Lisbon Lions kind of stuff? Or
yeah, that's what it was for. They installed these lights. It cost £2 million to install these lights to the stadium. And yeah, that was pretty much it. I mean, it was.
And we're still talking about it now, so money well spent.
There can hardly be much criticism of Rodgers, though, deciding to jump ship now at this stage.
I think it's just the timing of it that annoys Celtic fans. Like, yeah. the thing about Brendan Rodgers is he was on the step to glory forever in terms of Celtic fans. Like, they would have, if you think about the esteem to which Martin O'Neill is still held by Celtic fans, think of that for Brendan Rodgers now, because he was on the verge of a treble. And regardless of what you think of the SPFL or Scottish football in general, that's a big achievement for Celtic, and it's something that you can't disregard in terms of Celtic history. So they were one step away from erecting a statue outside Parkhead for him.
Right.
And it sort of taints his legacy a little bit. But at the same time, I don't think Celtic fans are that mad at him for leaving, because I thought a lot of them felt that he should have walked at the start of the season when they didn't back him. And he probably should have walked at the start of the season when they didn't back him. And they didn't back him in the transfer window to buy players, and then they kind of kicked him in the nuts again by selling their best player, Moussa Dembélé, for $18 million mid-season. They sold him in September, so like he was always kind of on the back foot, and the season started off poorly, and it hasn't really got much better.
He's obviously been waiting for the right opportunity to come about, by the sounds of things.
For me, the big issue is that, okay, he's decided to leave, which is understandable, but he's leaving mid-season, like I say, when the treble is on the cards. I mean, it just seems a bit mad that he's not waiting another 3 months. Would Leicester have been in such a massive rush to appoint him now? I mean, they're not going to get relegated,
see,
Leicester.
That's the thing. It's the fact that Leicester, they're not going to get Europe at this stage, and they're not going to get relegated at this stage. Could they not have just appointed someone from the club for 3 months if they wanted Brendan Rodgers that much? Because I think Brendan Rodgers is the sort of hire that is starting off a project, so he'll be at Leicester for at least 3 years.
There could be an element though of Rodgers. I mean, if like what you were talking about there, Enda, like Rodgers trying to give it a bit back to the board as well and leave them stuck in it a bit.
See, that could be it. It could be, you know what, the board never showed me any loyalty. Why should I show them any loyalty as well?
It's more on your CV. You're literally throwing away at least one trophy, if not two or three trophies. You're Brendan Rodgers. You haven't won too many trophies in your career. There's three trophies here waiting for you. Certainly one of two or two of those three are available to you fairly handily, you would think. And you're throwing them away to manage Leicester. I mean, again, I agree it's a job he should have taken, but he should have taken it in the summer is my point.
Yeah, like he's won 7 domestic trophies in a row, and he hasn't lost a domestic cup game since he took over Celtic. So by the end of the season, another treble. It depends what way you look at it. I saw someone on Twitter saying that maybe a treble might have weakened his position because it would have shown how weak Scottish football is at the minute. I think that's complete nonsense.
That's rubbish.
I mean, depending on whatever standards you hold the Scottish League, Neil Lennon wasn't able to do a treble, and now Brendan Rodgers is able to do an invincible season and a treble. I mean, you win a treble, that's impressive in any league relative to what you're playing, and I think that's what people leave out. The fact that Celtic are playing in the SPFL because, like, they don't have much competition, but at the same time, to maintain that amount of league games and that amount of cup games and play in Europe, that no other team in Scotland are playing in Europe, and they're still competing to the highest degree, it shows the esteem to which the players hold Brendan Rodgers, that they want to just keep going and keep winning things. Like,
yeah,
it's easy to get complacent.
It's that motivation, really, isn't it? Just to keep, we talked about, you know, Ferguson, you know, reinventing and keeping them going. That was one of his biggest qualities, was the fact that he was able to keep a freshness in the squad. Now, I know he did it with some high profile boots out the door and all that, but I think it's been shown, and you only have to look at, of course, a number of various platforms of sports, how difficult it is to keep repetitive to winning. It's not an easy thing, no matter what the quality or the opposition is, just to keep motivation, and particularly with professional footballers.
A man called Alex Ferguson once did it.
He did. He did.
Let's move on.
That's the point I'm making is it shows the quality of the job that he was doing. I just find, just not to repeat it, I just find the timing absolutely incredible. I
I can fully understand why he would take the Leicester job. I think that's a good move for him. I think he has a lot of potential there to do quite well at Leicester. I think Leicester fans and everybody involved in the club are very vocal about the lack of quality of the football.
I think it's a good appointment for Leicester as well, to be honest, because I actually think he's a good manager. And yeah, I'll be honest, I think the worst thing that happened to Brendan Rodgers was almost winning the league in 2014, because it completely raised expectations
but
at Liverpool.
They're not going to finish above seventh.
Yeah, but you would hope that like, I think he's a good manager. I think there's a bit of money there, not a whole lot of money, but a bit of money there, and they have a decent-ish squad that they can push into maybe that
he can mould in as well, and you can see him doing quite well. But I think he's enough of stature to go, look, yeah lads, I'll agree to take the job, but let me finish here first, and Celtic, I'll take it in the summer. Yeah. And I think that all parties involved would have agreed to that and jumped to that. I just find it so strange that I know he's had his difficulties with the board, and he seems like they've really, really got under his skin, and this might be the two fingers. But for his own legacy, you know, he could have, like, no matter how passionate the Celtic fans are, and Inda will speak a bit more on this, this has to leave a bit of a sour taste, the fact that you leave with a couple of months to go. And you know, he spoke about players' loyalty, etc., etc. I just that I can't get my head around. And I just find it strange that he didn't just say, look, I'll join in the summer and that's it. And then nobody, Celtic fans would have been, you know, away you go, you're a legend here. That statue would have been put up. They would have talked to him in folklore for the amount of victories and the amount of trophies that he's won. Now it's a little bit distasted, and I just find it a strange timing.
So you wonder why his hand forced in some ways. Were there two options? Leicester said, we have two options here. One is, I don't know who the other option will be, but one is available here. You're not available. So either you make yourself available or we're going with option B here. You know what I mean? So I'm wondering, was his hand forced in some ways? Because if it wasn't, it makes no sense to me.
Perhaps, but I think he's enough of calibre to go, you know, if you want me, wait in the summer. I think he was he had enough authority to do that. Look, time will tell. Like, it's going to be interesting. He's going to jump straight into a difficult position now with Leicester, because it's, you know, no pre-season, going to come into a squad that's been a little bit, you know, you spoke about the Chelsea squad being a bit of mutiny. You saw that a bit as well with Leicester, particularly with the Vardy incident and not playing, etc., etc. And you know, they changed possession, and the fans are going to expect a certain style. They're always going to compare back to that Premier League winning season. So yeah, he has a job on his hands, but I think he's more than capable of doing it. I think they will need a bit of patience though, and it'll be interesting to see how much money he's given in the summer, because that's probably going to be key. And you can imagine when he's speaking with Leicester after being burned really by Celtic, and Enda again is touching on it there, but the dealings and, you know, that spending the money on the disco lights, just for me, just must have been the biggest punch in the jaw.
I looked up the sources on that, and I wouldn't be so trusting of the sources on that. I was looking up to see where the audit of that was, and it was part of a 4 million redevelopment, and it was a £2.3 million entertainment system. Included.
Yeah, entertainment.
Like, still, 2 or 3 million is a lot to be spending on it. Like, as you said, there, I think not to stick the fingers up the fans, say we'll go without the speakers or whatever they included in that 2.3 million and buy a defender, as you said.
God forbid fans would, you know, a Parkhead would sing and make noise without.
But it's not as if Celtic Park's this empty stadium like the Etihad that requires these systems. Like, the only time they use the lights is on game nights.
I love the day at the Etihad.
Jesus Christ.
I think you need to, like, wear in your head who you support in this, because it just so fuels your opinions.
I don't think so. I mean, come on, man.
And it's not like it's Old Trafford or anything like that, is it?
I bought a ticket for a Man City Arsenal game the day before it happened. I mean, it's an absolute joke. They're advertising tickets for the Schalke game the night before as well. I mean, they just can't sell out the stadium. But Celtic Park is a completely different scenario to that. It's renowned for its atmosphere. They don't need this system. They needed a defender. That was the biggest issue. And then they had to go, I'm not sure if you're familiar with the whole issues they had with Boyata, but Boyata was basically trying to force Brendan Rodgers' hands to leave the club, and Brendan Rodgers put him straight into the reserves and said, you're not going to be playing for this club unless you're completely loyal to this club. So I think with all that happening, and this season has just been a complete catastrophe in terms of dealings in behind closed doors and off the field issues, it just hasn't worked out for Brendan Rodgers this season. And I would say he was just completely and utterly fed up, and that's why he's decided to jump ship before the end of the season.
Do you think
I would have rather to see him finish out the season, but I would say that's probably why. He's probably just fed up with the whole situation.
Just interesting your opinion from a Celtic point of view, Enda. Do you think he's done amazingly in domestic form, and you know, I think it'll be hard to find a manager with a better ratio in terms of games to cups and etc. in the time frame. But I think the one thing you'll say is, unlike maybe the likes of Lennon, who's the complete opposite end of the spectrum altogether, his team struggle in Europe. And you look at the Europa League campaign this season, was horrible to say the least. Like, I saw a couple of the games, and when we were working together here, they were so bad to watch, and it was so easy to play against them and so easy to score against them. Do you think that'll leave a bad taste on his overall Celtic experience when fans look back, and leaving the abrupt nature of his departure to one side, just in terms of the football and the lack of a breakthrough in Celtic? Because you always think of Celtic, you know, European nights, you think back to some of the big wins they had, even Lennon, some of the big wins to have. You never really have any of those nights under Rodgers. Do you think that'll leave a kind of a bad sour mark on his CV when Celtic fans look back on it?
I don't think so. I think that just kind of cements the fact that the board failed to back him, because like Celtic didn't really need to improve domestically, but where they did need to improve was Europe, and that again falls into the category of not buying a defender, and that was evident in Brendan Rodgers' campaign. I mean, his game plan, his style of football kind of buys into that as well. Like, I mean, if you look at any of Celtic's big nights in recent history in the Champions League, they've been won by practical managers who bring big men behind the ball. I mean, Celtic's win over Barcelona under Neil Lennon, we had they had two shots on target, and two of them went in, and the rest of it was just back to the wall stuff. And same under Martin O'Neill, really practical. Gordon Strachan, really practical, getting big men, being really dangerous from set pieces. And Brendan Rodgers' game plan doesn't really fall into that category. And to be fair to Rodgers, he never really abandoned that, and that's sort of admirable in a way. But it's also one of the reasons Liverpool fans probably don't like him or think that he threw away the season. He never really abandoned his philosophy of playing nice football. And because Celtic played really nice football in Europe, but they just weren't good enough defensively, weren't strong enough when teams were attacking them. And I suppose I think it's just going to end up with the fans looking back, because they had a banner up before the game, and it said 10 in a row is not a project, back him or lose him. And that was about Rodgers. So that just shows you, like, the fans are more angry at the board. They're not angry at Rodgers.
That sums up for the rest of this tonight's show anyway. Joe Coffey, thanks for coming
in. Pleasure as always.
Derek Ryan.
Thank you.
Killian Woods.
Thanks, Ralph.
We're going to set up an interview with you and Ferguson alone next week.
We were going to try and set up an interview with Alex Ferguson talking about his managerial stint at Aberdeen.
Oh yeah, but that's because we knew we wouldn't get him on Man United. Jonathan Higgins, thanks for coming in.
Thank you very much.
Ian Roach.
Thanks, Ralph.
Enda Call, thanks for taking the call.
No worries.
That actually rhymed a little bit. Now, off to Bermuda, and Sam was shocking to see. Childhood friend of Stephen Doyle, colleague here, played for Flanagan's Onions in Bermuda, and started off by asking how he ended up moving to Bermuda and how he ended up joining the club.
I think it's about 10 years ago. I was working here in Dublin, wanted to get out of Dublin. Looked for jobs around the world or whatever, and a job came up in Bermuda. So I headed out there. I knew a friend of mine who had gone out the year before, so gave her a call, said, how are you getting on? She said, oh, loves it, you know, tropical island out in the North Atlantic. So myself and my girlfriend went out and meant to spend like a year or two there, ended up like 5 or 6 years there. So
it's a bit off the beaten track in terms of us getting to Bermuda, isn't it, in terms of flights and everything. So what's the general journey like for both a tourist or somebody who's going over to work and live?
Yeah, there's really two ways to get there. You can either go to London and get a direct flight from London, because it is a British colony. Or you can go to the States, New York, and get a flight from New York down to Bermuda. It's about a 2-hour flight from New York. So New York will kind of be the nearest in the States, and then or go through London. So like Bermuda has kind of UK and American influences equally.
Yeah. And what's the general size of the Irish kind of contingent that are there, or is there much of a community?
Yeah, I think like population, I haven't checked in a while now, but it's about 65,000-70,000 in total.
Yeah.
An expat community then is probably about 15,000.
Two Leitrims where I come from. Yeah. More or less. Yeah. So it is very, very small.
Yeah. Expats about 15,000. And that would be made up of, you know, Irish, English, Scots, Welsh, US, Canada, Jamaica, everywhere else. It's about 15,000 people there. But, you know, it's been there for years. So there's kind of a ready-made community. Once you get over there, there's like people who are doing the exact same thing that you're doing, and you can easily just kind of fill in and meet people.
And economically, it's quite a strong kind of nation in a way, even despite its size and everything else, obviously through the British influence as well.
Yeah, no, it is. It's very strong in the insurance industry, which is where I work, and tourism, because it is a beautiful island, but it's quite expensive to live there. Like a pint of milk could be, you know, $5.
Oh, really?
So, now it's a tax-free island, so you're earning well, but you're paying a lot of in like your basic groceries. When you're going in, you're spending $100 just getting your basics kind of stuff. Yeah. So they've kind of outpriced themselves the last couple of years. It's so expensive that the tourists probably don't come as much into the island.
Yeah.
But they're very strong on their financial services. Kind
yeah.
of stuff.
And yeah. then you touched on the lifestyle. Obviously, it's not technically in the Caribbean. It's a little bit further north. But what are we kind of looking at in terms of what people do day to day? And maybe is there kind of like a beach culture or that kind of thing?
Yeah. So it's not Caribbean, but similar type culture. Yeah. So it is in the North Atlantic. Has its kind of its, you know, financial services industry, which is very strong, and a lot of Bermudians would work in that as well. Mm. But because the island's so small, you're kind of 9 to 5. As soon as you're finished, you're on your moped and you're straight to the beach. Like, there's a lot of sports on the island. Every kind of sport really there. Like,
cricket's pretty big as far as I know, isn't it? That's the biggest sport in the country.
Yeah.
And then football would be kind of number two.
That's right, yeah. They kind of have their national holidays around cricket. They take 4 days off. They do cricket for Thursday and Friday, and then they have the Saturday and Sunday off. So it's like a 4-day bank holiday, and it's pretty crazy. Like, but yeah, they do love their cricket.
So you were based in Hamilton, am I right? Mm. Which is actually very small when you look at the population, 1,100, something like that. And obviously Flanagan's Onions are based there as well.
Yeah.
So the Flanagan's part, that comes from the pub, isn't it?
Yeah, so so I suppose the history of the club, that which is now Flanagan's Onions, like, it used to be an office team, I think, like a KPMG or one of those kind of set it up, and in a kind of an office corporate league, and then it moved into a kind of a pub league. So there was a pub called MR Onions.
I've seen a picture of the pub now as well. I checked it out on Google Maps, and loads of Guinness awning and stuff outside.
Yeah, it's all the usual stuff that you'd see in a kind of an Irish. Well, that's the Flanagan's one, but there was one called MR Onions initially kind of took it over. I think the name actually came from is people's, Bermudians are called onions because, an onion is kind of the only thing that would really grow in the soil in Bermuda. So it was a kind of a strong export.
Yeah.
So Bermudians got known as the onions, as onions. So they're called MRs, like, you know, Demar Onions, it was called MR Onions. So anyway, that was the pub that kind of took over that corporate team and put it into a kind of a pub league. And then when that closed down, actually the weekend that I arrived into Bermuda, that pub was closing down, and people were taking paraphernalia out of the pub. They're taking the jukebox out of the pub and everything. Like, so Flanagan's was an Irish bar, and they decided to take over the Onions football team and kind of keep it running. Like, because it was a big enough club now. It's kind of like the club where all the expats would go and play.
Okay. Because there's other clubs like and a lot of catchy names here. Like Flanagan's Onions is catchy because of the Flanagan's part for us over here, and obviously the Onions part. But there's Dandytown Hornets, am I right? And there's a couple of other kind of names, the ex-Road Warriors, something like that as well.
Yeah, they're all quite funky names, all right. And like, they do have a Premier League, which is, you know, run by the BFA and the Bermuda Football Association, which would be, you know, part of FIFA and all that official stuff. So about kind of 10 teams in the first division. And then you'd have about 10 teams in the Premier, and about 10 teams in the first division.
And Flanagan's kind of go between the two, really, isn't it?
Yeah.
Of more of a yo-yo club, yeah.
Yeah, so I mean, they were just a pub team, but we were quite strong. We had kind of three teams within our club. You'd have kind of your A team, your B team, then like a Masters kind of over 35s, over 40s. But we got kind of so strong that we said we'd apply for the proper league, the Premier, and they allowed us to do that. Now, they weren't going to because we didn't have a youth system. I mean, all the teams had to have a proper youth system, but they let us in. I think they were kind of short two teams, so they kind of let two of the commercial league teams, the kind of pub teams, in and see how they get on. But we actually got promoted, I think, after a couple of years, stayed up in the Premier League for probably about 2 or 3 years. I think last year they just got relegated.
Yeah.
I haven't been there in about 5 years now, which is probably why they've been relegated. Like, you know, but yeah, they're still going. I was talking to the club chairman yesterday. I was telling him I was going to do a little piece on it. Like, he was excited because they're actually 30 years this year established.
Yeah.
So Yeah, no, it was good. So they got a, I don't think anyone expected them to get into the Premier and then stay there. But obviously they've been relegated now. But it's they now have a youth system as well. So
three teams, isn't it, in terms of that within the structure of their club now as well? Yeah.
Yeah. So, so you'd have the Premier or the First Division team. You've got a team in kind of the commercial corporate league. There's a separate corporate league, and then they have the Masters team. But then they have a youth system as well. Okay. So I think they have an under 9s, under 11, under 13, under 15s now, which is great because a lot of the lads who I know probably have kids now as well, so they're starting to put their own kids through it and that. So, yeah, that's great.
How do you end up being recruited by the club as well, and how do they tend to do that in Bermuda? Is it just a question of, you know, because as you said, it's more of an expat club in a way, and that a lot of people involved would be there probably working, but how do they get kind of attracted to
the club? Yeah, so like, I would have turned up at my job, and in my job interview, the guy was like, you know, what team do you support? Do you like football? And, you know, do you like beach? He was going to say no to that. And then kind of as soon as you get over there, they're saying, look, go and meet this guy. He's in charge of the football team. And then you kind of get straight into the expat team that way. There's Bermudians all through our team. It's no longer an expat team. It's a proper, member of the Bermuda Association now. Like, so it's kind of got a bit more serious and it's moved on from its origins. But it's funny because it is 30 years old this year. I was talking to the president. He was kind of just going through he was kind of baffled himself about how they've actually changed and stuff like that.
Did the name jump out to you in the same way that it jumped out to me and Steve-O in the office?
Absolutely. I mean, I don't want to play for a club that's called an onion. Like, you know, it doesn't sound great until you find out why they're actually called.
What the origin of it is.
Onions, yeah.
Yeah, isn't it? Onions till we die.
Onions till we die, yeah.
It's a slogan, yeah.
And they do kind of adopt all of the usual stuff you'd find in like an English club and that. I mean, they had an ultras section. I think they call themselves the 255 because.
What size would we be talking about in terms of ultras, and then maybe just the fans who drift in and out?
Well, so you'd probably have about three teams in the club and then three squads. So, I mean, whatever amount that is. Ultras would really be just the people who probably used to play for the club and got too old. So you're probably talking about 30 people or something like that. But they call themselves the 255 because they'd leave the pub at 2:55 and go to the match at 3 o'clock. Give themselves 5 minutes to to get up to the match, but like they had all that kind of stuff. You know, we'd have end of season dues, and you do Phoenix from the Flames and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And it'd be great. We'd one guy, he's a bit of a Lothario on the island, and I think they filmed him one day coming out of the houses of all the wives of the players on the first team, and they were all in on it, and they're kind of giving him a kiss and stuff. And it's a proper. They run it like a proper English club or Irish club or whatever.
How did you find the standard of play compared to, say, what you would have played, like the levels you would have played at here before going over?
Yeah, like I played for Kilnamana, schoolboy up to about under 18s, and in the top league in the schoolboy, and it was pretty good in that. It's again, you could find, because they had three teams, you could find your level in it. We weren't amazing, but we brought something else to it because we played like an Irish and English style.
Yeah.
So, you know, the Bermudian natural style is more keep it on the ground, pass it. Now, Bermudians are kind of a bit smaller in stature, and we were kind of bringing more of an agricultural type of football. That's what was expected of us. So, you know, long balls into the box, get the big man out of it, that kind of stuff, hard tackling. But then we kind of developed into, you know, suddenly they could see us playing football, so they're kind of going expecting all these long balls, and suddenly we're playing kind of good football. So it kind of worked to our advantage. We could pull on both styles, if you know what I mean.
We once had a former Bermudan international on the show, so Clyde Best would be one of the more well-known kind of names. And then obviously I think Sean Goater, that's where he's from as well. Do these names still resonate there, or is it cricket so big that maybe they're...
No, it's like football is probably on a level with cricket. And Sean Goater would be a legend on the island. I mean, he'd be the most famous, obviously. Yeah. You know, feed the goat and he will score. Yeah, I think there's actually a Bermudian guy playing for Sligo Rovers.
Dante Leverock, I think it is. Yeah. He's just moved over,
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, they haven't had a lot of, you know, famous players, but I was looking at the international team's squad, and I spotted the Sligo Rovers at the moment. But you'd have them kind of speckled through the First Division in England and stuff, and playing in Bermuda as well. Like, a couple play for clubs in the States and Canada as well. Like, Yeah. Probably because it's so close.
And football culture-wise, in terms of what happens like post-game and things, is it naturally everyone kind of heads towards the pub, or what way was it? Is it well, I guess it's obviously not the Premier League way of having to baths and all that.
No. It was, I mean, every, like, the football pitches would be doubling up their clubhouse with the cricket team. Mm-hmm. So each clubhouse would have its bar, and you'd be straight into the bar after the match and mingling with the other team. And that would happen after every match. So it did have that good culture.
Yeah.
They're far from ice baths, I think, at the moment. Like, but
well, there's ice and something else, but not the bath.
No, exactly. No, it was good. It even got to the point where we had our own Jaeger machine. You know, those Jaeger machines where it can kind of, I think it gives out like 3 shots of cooled Jaeger into the shot glasses. We called it Adolf.
Yeah.
For reasons that you end up quite messed up after it. But we used to bring that with us to every game and like bring that into the clubhouse after and get the other team all drinking and stuff. So I think that's still there, that machine.
Do you kind of miss the general, like the involvement in that club in particular? Or
Yeah, absolutely. And it became kind of famous for its, you know, its, I think you say we win on the pitch and we lose off the pitch. That was the kind of the motto of the club. Like, but yeah, you miss all that camaraderie and all that kind of stuff. But I still get to go over to Bermuda kind of twice a year. And I get to jump in and play with one of the teams. So they can actually, you know, they can register you fairly quickly and get you if you want to play for the Premier team if they need you. But if not, I'll probably play for the Masters team when I go over next. Like, so.
And was there much interest from here, well, apart from Stephen, obviously, in more recent times, but in terms of the fact that you were playing for a club in Bermuda, but also given the name, and obviously Flanagan's is an Irish name, so it would have been out, but were you getting much interest from over here in terms of people kind of asking a few questions about the club and that?
Not really. I think I put up the odd photo on Facebook or whatever of tackling a couple of the guys and stuff like, but no, not a lot. I mean, if you hear kind of Flanagan's Onions, you think it's a pub team, even though it's a full member of their, you know, official association. But you know, the national team, it's never really done too well. I don't think it's.
Do you ever go to any of their games or
Yeah, so they have a couple of either their friendlies or a qualifying game in their national stadium. So I've been to a couple of the games.
Because they'd be in CONCACAF, I guess, with obviously the big names in that are the Mexicos, Canada, United States.
Exactly.
And
yeah.
They're kind of a slightly lower level.
Well, yeah. So I mean, you know, they're probably in a lower qualifying group again against, you know, St. Martin's or Cayman or some of the other kind of islands and stuff. So they never kind of make it. I don't think they've actually ever got to a World Cup qualifying proper even. But, you know, it's a tiny tiny country.
Yeah, it's all about being involved anyway. I think it's kind of the main thing. And obviously, given the fact it is, you know, the club is affiliated with the Bermudan FA, there is a CONCACAF Champions League, so in theory, theoretically, you could actually go all the way to that level.
Yeah, no, in theory you could.
Maybe not so much in practice. Like, I mean, there are a few clubs that seem to dominate there as well. I think because the likes of Somerset Trojans and stuff would be.
So the good players would kind of filter through to kind of the top two teams.
And then end up potentially playing in a Champions League of sorts. Yeah. Well, it's all very, very fascinating. And even I was looking back, because whenever we had Clyde Best on, just in his book, he was talking about playing for a club called Ireland Rangers as well. Mm. So there's a few little names and things there that would probably jump out to us, whether it be Ireland Rangers, Flanagan's Onions or whatever it is. So that's all very... very interesting. But Sam O'Shaughnessy, thanks a million for coming in and enlightening us. It's just a pity Stephen Doyle couldn't be here so he couldn't embarrass him about his past footballing ability.
I could have told you a couple of stories about Twinkle Toes, but maybe.
We'll bring him in here for a special interview.
Maybe the next
part.
Time. Maybe the next time we'll go through his history of soccer. But thanks very much.